Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're very glad to have you listening. We're also very pleased to welcome back to the program Jim Kaler. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy here at University of Illinois. He's been here at the university since 1964, has been a teacher, has also written for many popular magazines. He was a consultant for Time Life Books on their Voyage Through the Universe series. He has been interviewed often on Illinois television and radio. He's published a number of books, just to mention a couple: Stars and Their Spectra, Extreme Stars, The Little Book of Stars, The Greatest Hundred Stars, so you can tell
what he's interested in.
He's interested in stars. And also, he's done two audio courses for Recorded Books and Barnes & Noble, and currently serves as Vice President of Directors of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. And occasionally, he's here on the program, and we talk a little bit about what you can see in the sky at that time of the year. And then, if people have other kinds of questions about astronomy and space exploration, I think he would do his best to give you an answer.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad to have you back with us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Always a treat.
Do you want to just start off, as we have in the past, by just talking a little bit about what you can see in the sky right now?
Sure. Two big bright planets, one in the evening, one in the morning, depending upon your proclivities, whether you like to go out in the early evening and find Jupiter. Mars is there, but it's very difficult to see right now in twilight, so you can sort of forget that. But they just look to the southwest for the brightest thing you can see, and that's Jupiter, big, bright, and beautiful. Over to the right is a star, Spica, in the constellation Virgo. Libra is to the left of it. If you got even binoculars, you can use them, 7-power binoculars, use them on Jupiter, hold them very steadily. You can see Jupiter's moons. Telescopes just give you a glorious view. And in the morning sky, we got Venus. Again, it's not hard to find, just the brightest thing you can see. And we got, as a special astronomical treat coming up, we have arranged for you to see Mercury and Venus at the same time coming up next week. If you find Venus, look just below it, you'll see Mercury, the two very close together in the sky. It gives you a good guideline for finding the innermost planet, which most people can't find. I mean, I have trouble finding it myself unless I get a little guideline myself. It's tough to see.
Mm-hmm.
And once the moon gets out of the way, it's growing now, and once the moon gets out of the way in a little while, this is a grand time to see the Milky Way. Not from Champaign-Urbana, mind you. It's a little dim from here because of the light pollution in town. But even if you get a few miles out of town, a little south of the airport or just away from the direct city lights, you can see that band of light going across the sky. The farther away you get, the darker the sky, the better it gets. And you don't need guidelines to find the summer Milky Way. It's quite a spectacular sight in a really dark sky. If you can hop on your corporate jet and get out to Colorado Mountains or something like that, it's even a better view from high altitude. Beautiful, beautiful sight. It's a disk of the galaxy. We're sort of set off to the side, and you can see the combined light literally of billions of stars out there for hundreds, thousands of light years away.
Yeah. Venus is really – I'm not going to see it early in the morning. I guess I think about that. But the only thing I can think of that's good when it gets dark so early in the fall – is that Venus is up and it's very bright and it's really outstanding.
Well, when you get the late sunrises, then almost on your way to work in the wintertime. But Venus is disappearing by the end of the year. It'll be pretty much gone. It's rising. I've been tracking the beginning of twilight. It's rising, tracks the beginning of twilight almost all year long so far. And it will gradually disappear and pop up in the evening sky next year for us.
Yeah. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL if you have questions. We are coming up to a meteor shower.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that, yes. But unfortunately, the moon is going to pretty much kill it. It's going to be just past full. These meteor showers most of them tend to be at their best in the early morning hours when you're on the side of the Earth sweeping them up, and you get more of them. The Perseid shower, which the perspective effect makes these critters seem to come out of the constellation Perseus, although it's always best to look straight overhead for them. In a dark sky, you can see 100 to 200 a minute, depending upon the what year it happens to be and how the concentration of the debris, the stuff is coming off a reasonably well-known comet. And it's just comet disintegration stuff. That's what most meteors are, although a few of the and occasionally you'll see a few asteroids hitting the Earth. Mm. Almost all of it burns up. If a few of the larger asteroids get through, hit the ground, become meteorites, but the comet stuff, as far as we know, never does. It all just burns up overhead and gives you a nice show.
Yeah,
but you'll only see the brighter ones this year. It's not a particularly good year for them.
I think I read somewhere that the peak actually here in our part of the country, the peak would actually be during the daytime.
That will often happen, yeah, because the debris bands, although the Perseids go on for a couple of weeks anyway, a gradual build up, but you hit the main debris band, and it usually lasts a few hours. So you're not going to see them in the daytime, yeah. But people with radar equipment will see them because they produce ionization, an ion tube through the air, and that'll bounce radio waves. And there are various tricks of using distant FM signals as well that will, where you say an FM station a few hundred miles away will bounce off the trail left by a meteor, and you can get these little flashes of signal from. So you can observe them in the daytime if you have the equipment for it.
And the actual object that's causing this is just a little speck of stuff?
Yeah, it's a pea-sized piece of fluff. Occasionally you'll get, there's some meteor showers that'll produce things a foot or more across, you know, fairly big bombs, but they're so fragile, they just disintegrate.
Yeah, so nobody should worry about one of these things hitting their
No. You don't get hit by a asteroidal debris can hit. There have been people who have been hit by these things. And as far as I know, nobody's ever been killed by one. But a few houses get it every couple of years, somebody will get smacked by a meteorite, mm-hmm. but your chances of getting run over by a rampaging semi in the quad is much higher than that. So okay. It's nothing you need to worry about.
Well, look both ways when you cross the quad. We have a call here to talk with. Let's do that in Belgium, over near Danville, on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Hope you had a nice vacation, sir.
Thank you.
Both of you, I guess, maybe then, huh? Anyway. The question I had is, a while back here, I was surfing the net, and I came across a picture that was one of the most spectacular pictures I've ever seen. And it was a picture of a sunset and a moonset, both exactly at the same time. And it was taken at a fairly high latitude, I think.
I've got a copy of it.
Ah, now how did they do that?
Fakery.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
I was going to say, how could those two go together?
You can't.
No way.
It's a complete fake. It's very pretty. It's a very nice piece of art, but that's all it is. Uh-huh. You just can't do that.
Yeah.
I had a query about it a few months back and located it on the web myself and almost fell off my chair.
No.
You can take any photograph. You know, you could you can fake almost anything with modern digital techniques. You could fake almost anything with classic photographic techniques as long ago as decades, centuries ago. There's a classic tale of the two girls in England who cut out pictures of fairies and put them on bushes and took photographs of them back a century ago with their little box camera and caused a sensation because everybody believed it.
Yeah, it reflecting in this pool of water.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yes, yeah. it's also extraterrestrial because it sure doesn't happen here.
Yeah, I was going to say, how in the world could you get the light to bounce that way?
No, the whole thing is just put together.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free. Anywhere that you can hear us, either around Illinois and Indiana, or even if you were listening on the web, that's 800-222-9455. Anything else in terms of what's up in the sky that you want to mention?
Well, you can see the center of the galaxy down. Follow the Milky Way down towards Sagittarius. You'll see a little bit above the horizon of the south. You'll see this little upside-down five-star Dipper figure. And just to the right of it is the center of the galaxy where there's a monster black hole, which won't eat us up since it's a very long ways away, 25,000 light years away. But it is detected by radio and X-ray observations. And it's sort of a conceptual thing. You're looking off in that direction and thinking about the nature of this system of ours, of 200 billion stars all centered around a multi-million solar mass black hole in the middle. It's a fascinating system, and it's typical galaxy. We're just sort of stuck off at the side of the thing in a very quiet place of it where nothing much fortunately happens because there's some pretty violent events out there, but they tend to be fairly far away and just of interest to look at.
Let me ask you a question. This is a goofball question, but that's pretty much what I do. Just now,
I give you a goofball answer.
Okay, good. Okay. The moon is just now these days. The moon is up in the southwest. Is that right?
Yeah, comes, depending upon the time of day you look in. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking of when I'm going. I guess I'm taking out the trash at about 10 o'clock at night, and the moon is it's very beautiful and up in the southwest. Here now, somebody asked me this the other day, and I didn't know the question. The answer in the southern hemisphere. Is the moon at that time also in the southwest?
If you look at it here in the southwest, down there, it'll be in the southwest, too. It'll just look backwards because you're looking in the other direction.
So it's in the same
place. I mean, it always rises
east,
sets
in the west. But the phases, as they go,
it'll appear flipped, yeah, because you're looking in the, you're standing there looking in the other direction at it. So here, if you look at the face to the north, let's say the sun will rise in the on the right and set on the left there, you're looking on the south, it'll rise on the left and set on the right. I mean, things look backwards down there. It's a real stinker to try to identify constellations if you're used to it in the northern hemisphere, and you go down in the southern hemisphere and you look at it, it looks alien because everything's upside down, and you almost have to dip yourself upside down to start recognizing things. It's a very odd experience.
So the constellations themselves are in the same place.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But they're also
sure. Yeah, it's just a matter of your orientation
around
on the planet. You just tend to be looking in the other direction. Instead of looking away from the North Pole, you're looking away from the South Pole. And things look flipped. And it takes a little getting used to, that's all.
Okay. Well, very good. One of the things that I want to talk a little bit about, this is not exactly news now anymore, but it was something that I was saving that I thought you might say a couple of things about, and that is about relatively new telescope, the Combined Array for Research in Millimeter Wave Astronomy, that was officially dedicated a couple months ago in the beginning of May, and that the University of Illinois, as well as some other universities, this is a joint project.
Yeah, it's a joint operation of the what was originally the Berkeley, Illinois, Maryland Association array of telescopes out in California. And we got a new site and merged that with the Caltech array and produced a massive new system of telescopes. With a single radio telescope, you get really bad detail because radio waves are so long, much longer than light waves, so you don't get good resolution of celestial objects with them. So what you do is take two or more telescopes and separate them by a big distance, and that gives you much more detail. And then you can get better and better detail by sticking more and more into a large array of instruments spread out over a very wide area on the ground. This is a state-of-the-art instrument. It's one of the U of I's, I think, proud research facilities in I would say one of the best we have on this campus, in a sense, except it's in California, on a high plateau. You know about high plateaus. We don't have any in the state of Illinois. And that gets you above a lot of water vapor, which can cause problems with millimeter wave or shortwave radio. But it's just sort of gotten underway, and it should produce some spectacular new results in looking for regions of star formation, stellar death processes, and looking at other galaxies in long wave. The short wavelength end of the radio spectrum.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about the various. There are those things that we can see that we could look through a telescope and you could see. But there's all kinds of energy.
Oh yeah,
that
we look at in musical terms. It would be like having a piano keyboard a mile long, and you're allowed to play one octave with your eyes, and it really limits the music that you can hear from space, in a sense. The great triumph of anything that happened in the 20th century astronomically was the opening of the entire keyboard from long wavelength radio through this little bit of optical access we have to the heavens. Fortunately, stars produce most of their energy in this little bitty optical band, mm-hmm. which allows you to do a great deal of research. But there's so many things out there that radiate just radio waves or just X-rays or just infrared or whatever in the long wave or the short wave part of the spectrum where the eyes can't see, that we missed so much. And the opening of this spectrum through various technologies has allowed us to begin really to get a sampling of all the things that are out there in the universe we had no clue about a century ago.
We have a caller here, somebody who's calling on a cell phone. They're on the road, so let's get to them, and this will be line number one. Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi.
I'm delighted to hear the program. I hate to revert back to the optical after talking about the
other optical's fun. You can see you can see stuff with it.
I've wanted to ask this question for a long time. I wonder what your guests thought of the decision that apparently has been made not to resurface or power the Hubble Space Telescope. The photographs from that have been so spectacular, and even for lay people like myself, they are works of art, and I just can't imagine that. That's not somehow worth the money that would take to get it fixed so it would stay active. And I wonder what your guests thought of that.
Oh, I think it's a sad day for us to shut down this magnificent instrument that has, to a good degree, revolutionized astronomy. It's a... I can't say enough good things about the Hubble, about the way it's been run, about its spectacular scientific achievements, which often really don't make it to the public, even the public outreach that they've done has been extremely good. The imaging, which is really a small part of what the instrument does, has been spectacular, and they've pumped a great deal of effort into giving an appreciation of the cosmos to people through newspapers, magazines, and the web. They've got a beautiful website where you can read all the press releases and the like. A great deal of the work is done spectroscopically, where you're breaking the light up into its component colors from the ultraviolet through the infrared. That has produced an immense amount of information. The upside of it is that if the Hubble finally is put to rest, and it's still going to be a little while because it's still got a fair bit of life left into it. Part of the problem is the deterioration of the gyroscopes that allow for the pointing of it, and they're running it, I believe, now on two of the six gyros. Nevertheless, there is an immense amount of data that have yet to be mined from that thing, because you take a set of observations, you always get peripheral stuff. In fact, you can look with one instrument and another instrument is pointing in the other direction, just gathering data that nobody particularly needs at the moment, but it'll be archived and eventually mined. So we can live off the data from the instrument for a very long period of time.
Are there plans in the works to supplement or to replace the Hubble with something more state of the art?
I can't even remember the name of it now. It was given the name of NASA administrator, but the next generation was called the Next Generation Space Telescope, which will be considerably larger and optimized for the infrared spectrum. It's really meant as a cosmology machine,
to look for the distant universe.
Coming along, but it's not the general purpose instrument that the Hubble is.
Right.
The Hubble is sort of a ground-based instrument raised into orbit. A ground-based instrument, you can slap new instrumentation on it and use it in a great variety of different ways. And the Hubble was designed that way, and there's no other instrument that is planned to have that kind of capability.
Is it a fait accompli that it's going to die?
I don't think so. I just keep hearing one thing, and then it switches and back, and it's sort of bouncing around at this point, and I'm not sure servicing is completely dead yet.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Keep your fingers crossed. Write your congressman.
Thank you very much.
But it's a glorious instrument, and thanks for the chance to talk about it.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Other comments, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Jim Kaler. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at the University of Illinois. I guess I had thought that maybe that the the issue was still under discussion.
It is, I think. I think it is. And it depends on who you talk to. I don't know what the resolution of it will be. I think it's still got a couple of years, certainly a few years life left in it, even if they don't service it. But gradually things deteriorate. I mean, it's like anything else. If you didn't service your car, you know, every few years, it would gradually die. And you've got to get the one of the great beauties of the Hubble is that it is serviceable. The next generation, the new space telescope, will not be. It'll have a specific lifetime. And once it's gone, it's gone. That's the case for most orbiting. There's a vast variety of orbiting telescopes that have spanned the spectrum from gamma rays through X-rays, a beautiful X-ray instrument, wonderful infrared telescope up there now, the Spitzer Space Telescope, that's producing vast amounts of data. None of this negates what's on the ground, of course. What we're doing on the ground just keeps getting better and better. And with the amount of data coming in, various survey telescopes here, planning what's called the Large Synoptic Telescope for the Southern Hemisphere, which will image the entire sky every three nights. Millions upon millions of stars looking for variations, looking for different celestial events and so on, ephemeral events, to the point where there's so much data available U.S. and other countries have put together what's called here we're calling it the National Virtual Telescope, which is you can simply observe through mining the data banks that are being acquired. When you have instrumentation that can take data at the rate of a terabyte per second, you've really got yourself you're dealing with gigabytes per second per night sometimes with what is being planned.
And it's just to make sure people understand what it is that's special about Hubble, is it basically the issue is that you don't have to look through the atmosphere?
Oh, sure.
That's the thing. It's up there above the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. You get it above the air. Stars twinkle on the ground as a result of turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere, and that smears out the image, which means you can't get a very good view of anything from the ground unless you can de-twinkle the starlight, which the U of I, in fact, has been at the forefront of instrument in Mount Wilson in California. But no large telescope is built now without these de-twinkling systems. Yet, you will ultimately probably be able to get as good an image from the ground as you can from space once these devices are perfected. But there are limitations to them, and the atmosphere does prevent shortwave radiation, ultraviolet, X-rays, and so on from getting through. Fortunately, otherwise we'd all be dead. But it also blocks the infrared. This is, of course, the flip side of global warming. The infrared can't get out because of the carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere, but neither can it get in. So you're really blocked from looking at lower energy processes from space. So you need space telescopes to get access these other wavelength bands. You're pretty limited from the ground.
Let's talk with somebody here on a cell phone west of Champaign. This would be line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I received an email from a friend the other day, one that's obviously been sent to many folks about Mars being very close to the Earth.
I think 2 years old. It's been roaming around the web for some time. We had a close approach. I can't remember the date. It was a couple of years ago. But the orbits are elliptical, and the next approach of Mars won't be quite as close. And there's a 15 to 17 year cycle. And we were pretty close a couple of years ago. But once you get notes and messages like that, they seem to take. It's like a pyramid club, you know. They have a mind of their own. One person sends them to the other and just keeps going around and around the world and never dies. It'll probably be alive 10 years from now.
Well, thank you. But one more question. In that email, it said that it was so close that the size of Mars would approach that of the Moon.
Oh, I know it. That drove I was driving Dave Leek at Parkland crazy, too. He was getting messages on that. In fact, it drove us all nuts. It's of course, nonsense. I think a paragraph got dropped out somehow. And what we sort of interpreted it to mean was that the view of Mars through a telescope would be similar to the view of the Moon with the naked eye from the Earth.
I see.
That was the best interpretation we could put – the kindest interpretation we could put on it. But no, Mars does not look as big It couldn't. Okay. It's always going to be the disk is unresolvable with the human eye. It'll look like a point source no matter what.
Gotcha.
And for sure, if it ever looked as big as the moon, we'd be in big, big trouble.
Big trouble. I thank you much.
All You're right. welcome.
Thank you for the call. It certainly was.
Bless the web and the internet. Things. There are websites out there 20 years. Well, they can't be 20 years old, but you know, once they're out there forever.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly was beautiful, and it was noticeably bigger and brighter than the naked
and
eye.
The last close approach was nice too, but not as good. And the next one, they come every couple of years, you get a close approach when Mars comes into opposition. But it's getting farther and farther from the sun at each passage between the Earth and the planet, and it's cyclic like that. When it gets at a favorable opposition, when Mars is closest to the sun and we pass between it and the sun, then it can get very bright. It can exceed Jupiter in brightness for a short period of time, and making actually the second brightest planet. But usually it's not. Jupiter usually exceeds it, and right now it's inaccessible.
Can you generally one way to identify Mars is that, at least to me, and I think to a lot of people, it does look a little reddish.
Oh, sure. And it kind of depends on the eyes. You can get into fierce and futile arguments with people about star colors and planet colors, because I think everybody sees things a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. I've got a lady that writes me from Europe on about the stars. I post a star of the week description every week with the skylights, and she's in love with blue stars, and she sees them as blue, and I see them kind of a very, very faded blue-white if they're hot. But the red ones just jump out at me, whereas other people don't see them that way. Yeah, Mars has a reddish color to it, hence it's called Mars after the god of war. I mean, everybody sees it as red. It's kind of, if you want to be picky, okay, maybe it's kind of a yellow-orangey reddish sort of thing, but it's semi-subtle. But there's stars with similar colors, and colors are even slightly redder than Mars. Mm. Take a look to the south and see the star Antares. The name comes from Antares, opposite of or similar to it. You mean pretty much the same thing. Mars. It looks like Mars. People think it's Mars. Even professional astronomers get fooled by it by thinking it's Mars.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is Jim Kaler. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at the University of Illinois. And by the way, he does do a regular column that appears on the U of I Astronomy Department webpage called Skylights, and it changes every week. And also there is the Star of the Week, and then there's a photo.
A photo of the week that involves the sky. It might be stars. It might be clouds. It might be a lot of Illinois. You're going to get a lot of clouds pictures, but it's a lot of fun to post.
All right. And if you're interested, that would be one place to go and get a little bit of information about what's in the sky. So you want to go to the U of I Astronomy Department webpage, which is www.astro.uiuc.edu.
Or you can stick Skylights Kaler into Google and it'll come up.
All right. That might be easier.
That's usually easier.
And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Someone up in Sycamore on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. A comment about the moon, and then a question. I saw that photograph about 3 or 4 months ago.
It
was supposedly taken from the high Arctic.
Yeah.
And as soon as I saw it, I said, wait a minute. There is no place on Earth you can go that the moon and the sun look very different in size.
Exactly. Exactly. They're the same angular diameter, half a degree. And it's just a coincidence of nature. The ratio of distance to size is the same for the moon and the sun. And that's what allows us our wonderful eclipses of the sun, because the moon can just barely fit over the disk of the sun at noon.
Right. And, you know, going to the high Arctic isn't going to change that appreciably.
No. Heaven's sakes, no.
So, anyhow, my question is about binocular telescopes. And I'm wondering if you've ever looked at planets through one. I've heard that planets are always better viewed through refracting telescopes. And, okay, if one is good, two with two separate optic systems leading to your individual eyes might be even better.
Probably. There are people who build binocular telescopes. They're amateur devices, and they're usually reflectors, but you can, I think, get or make binocular refractors. Refractors are better because they don't have the secondary mirror obstruction inside of them. And they can make them now without hardly any distortion at all. Some of the modern refractors are just spectacular, and I'm sure the view through a binocular one would be better. Some of it's psychological, I think, because you're viewing with both eyes open at the same time. But people who do look through them just swear by them. Such things are terribly expensive because you got to get two of them instead of one, and then you've got the usual alignment problem, same problem you've got with ordinary binoculars. People getting started in astronomy, just viewing the nighttime sky, are well advised to start with the naked eye and then step up to binoculars. You can get them in a variety of sizes and powers. I've got a pair of 16 by 80s at home that are so large you almost need a tripod for them. It's hard to hold them steady. In addition to several others, you can get beautiful views of things with binoculars. It's a great place to start.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Right,
well, thank you for the call. And again, other questions are certainly welcome. You can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to ask you about something else that apparently is maybe causing a little bit of talk in astronomy circles. There apparently are a small group of scientists who are raising questions about the concept of the black hole. And in fact, they've said, we don't think there is such a thing. And the rest of the astronomers think, no, that's not right.
I never heard of that.
Well, really?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm
sure there is. I mean, yeah. There you can always find a group of scientists who will counter any standard picture, and sometimes they're right, and usually they're wrong. There's always iconoclasts everywhere, and I'm afraid I'm unaware of that.
Okay. Well, I have an article I can give to you, and you can take a look at it and see what you. It's. I think their arguments. It's a little bit beyond. Me, they had actually a reason to say, you know, based on some data that they had, calling into question the concept of the black hole and saying that it was, you know, it was something else. So, well, you want to talk about black holes?
I guess so. they're black.
They're black and they're holes.
The concept is very old. It's just a body that's squeezed down, and it's a simple concept. A body that's squeezed down so much that. The gravity is so strong, light can't get out of it. The classical view of it is that the escape velocity from the surface, which is 7 miles per second from the Earth, if you shrink the Earth down, you get closer to the atoms, the gravity goes up, you get the higher and higher escape velocity. And if the Earth gets down to about the size of a golf ball, which you can't do, of course, light can't escape because the escape velocity hits the speed of light. Not entirely correct because it's really – this involves Einstein's relativity, and you really got to look at that with redshifts of light and so on. But the basic idea is that light can't get out. It loses all its energy in trying to do so, and the body simply disappears from view. Black hole. It's kind of a puncture in space-time in a way. Mm-hmm. That's the relativistic view of it. And the evidence for their existence, I mean, how do you see one? Well, it's like they're invisible. You can't see them. So you have to use indirect evidence of their surroundings, and they can have a powerful effect on their surroundings, and that seems to fit the theoretical models of black holes. I'm sure you can find counterarguments for them and bodies that behave strangely and that may not fit the theory of the black hole. In fact, I mean, this is how science works. I mean, you got a theory of them, and let's find some data that counter the theory. And if that's the case, then the theory is no good. But you got to be sure of your interpretations.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk with some other folks here.
There may be stellar black holes, probably almost certainly, about the sizes of stars or the masses of stars. And then there are these gigantic black holes, we believe, at the cores of galaxies, millions, mm-hmm. even billions of solar masses, to quote a friend.
All right. Let's talk with somebody in Paris, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Was reading in a magazine, I don't remember if it was Discovery or Astronomy, just recently, and they were questioning the theory about dark energy and dark matter, whether it's actually something that's out there, and it was going to throw Einstein's theories kind of into a tizzy. And I just wondered what your opinion on that was. I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, again, you got people who will try to, and rightfully so, negate the ideas of dark energy and dark matter. Dark matter comes about by things in the galaxy and outside the galaxy moving faster than you expect on the basis of what you can see, the gravitational effect that you can see, that you can round up from stars and everything else. The galaxy is spinning too fast, for example, and based on the number of stars in it. And you find in clusters of galaxies, the critters are just moving too fast. This goes back to the 1930s. And the only explanation anybody's going to has come up with is that there's something out there that's producing a gravitational field, but you can't see it. And they got the name dark matter. You know, you give it a name, it's kind of like you understand it, whereas we don't understand. Nobody knows what the stuff is. And then recently, within the last decade or so, we found that the expanding universe seems to be accelerating, and there doesn't seem to be any data that negate that at this point. And people have desperately tried to get out of this acceleration. And you get this from looking at very, very distant galaxies. And the methodology used seems to be good. It looks like the pace of the increase of the expansion of the universe is picking up. And the only way of explaining this is through this thing called dark energy, that there's an energy content to the universe at large, which is being thrown into the expansion of the universe. And we're clueless as to what it is. Now, maybe we'll find some way of getting around and saying, okay, the observations are wrong or they're being misinterpreted. That's been people have been working on knocking down the accelerating universe for some time now, and they haven't been able to do it. So we're stuck with if you combine mass and energy, which are equivalent, E equals MC squared and all that, then 70% of the mass energy of the universe is in this dark energy, and we don't have a clue as to what it is. And about a quarter of it is in dark matter, and only a very small minority is in stuff that you can actually see. Hmm. It's really put astronomy onto its head. There's an old rubric that all astronomical problems are solved in 25 years, and I think this is one that violates the law.
Okay, let's talk with someone in Danville, line number two. Hello.
Hi, I'm Josh Hayes. I was in the Navy for about 6 years, and a couple years ago I was out at sea for a Leonid star shower, meteor shower, and I happened to be on watch for like the 2 to 7 in the morning watch, and it was really just spectacular because there were no lights and everything, of course.
Yeah.
And I was wondering when the next really visible shower would be for the central Illinois area.
Well, the Perseids are coming up morning of August 13th, but the problem is, of course, the moon. That gets in the way.
Sure.
I can't remember specific dates, but the Geminid shower and the Orionids are coming up toward the end of October, the Geminids in December, and you can get them if you just stick those names into Google. You can put in Geminid 2006 and you'll see what the situation is. The moon is a real problem. Those are pretty good ones.
Yeah.
Then the Quadrantids in early January are often very good, but they're often excellent, in fact, but people don't usually like to lie out on their back looking at meteors in January. So it's not a very well-known shower for that reason. You said you saw the Leonids?
Yes.
Yeah, they're usually not very good. There's in mid-November. They have a 33-year cycle.
Yeah.
They were good over a span of a couple of years ago. And they were pretty spectacular. Not as good as the 67. It depends how close you go. The Earth passes to the bands of stuff that had been flaked off the 33-year period comet that produces them. The famous shower was that of 1833.
Uh-huh.
Which I was born just a little bit after that, so I don't remember that. But the estimates were 100,000 an hour.
That wow.
It was like a snowfall, and you could actually see the perspective effect as the Earth plowed through it. The one in 1799, I think it was supposed to be just as good. And the 1967 one was good, too, except it was cloudy here, of course.
Right. Yeah, a couple years ago, it was amazing. I'd never seen a shower like that.
Yeah, it turned out to be pretty darn good. Not as spectacular as some that have been seen in these meteor storms, but it was pretty good. I think the prediction is that for the next time, which would be about 30 years from now, Jupiter's going to change the orbit of the blob of stuff we pass through, and we're going to miss most of it. And that happens periodically as well. So because the ones in the early part of the 20th century weren't all that great either. And then Jupiter keeps messing around with it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Well, I'm sure that if you got to see one of these and you got to see it at the peak and it was a really good dark sky, it would be really
It's memorable, yeah. I've never seen a storm like that. The most famous one of the century, I think, was 1946 from one that never returned, the Draconid shower. It just surprised everybody. The sky was filled for a while with meteors and then just went away and never came back. So keep your eye on the sea. That's why I tell people, get out there and look at the sky. You never know what's going to happen up there.
It's too bad. It's
entertaining show.
The time when the humidity is less so that it will be clearer and be better viewing just happens to be in the wintertime. So I guess if you had a warm sleeping bag,
it's tough to look at meteors in the winter. you really get pretty chilly standing out. There are dedicated meteor hunters, though, that have most of this has been done by the amateur community, which has played a very large role in astronomy over the decades, if not the centuries, doing things that aren't enough professional astronomers to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with somebody here on the cell phone in, I think, in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to know, you said that there are lots of problems for astronomy to deal with and things you don't understand. I think it would also be correct to say that astronomy is likely to be a savior, if you will, of physics from itself. I think there's a book that came out. I wanted to recommend this because your readers might be interested, by Peter Woit, W-O-I-T, called Not Even Wrong. And it's published in England. It'll be coming out in the States in a couple of months, basically explaining what's wrong with string theory and we've been going in the wrong direction. And even more importantly, the famous physicist Lee Smolin, S-M-O-L-I-N, has a book coming out on September 21st in this country called The Trouble with Physics, How a New Science Was Born and Died, and What's Going On with physics.
Well, I think that's a little harsh.
Right.
Physics.
But the basic idea is that he is saying that for theoretical physicists, the only way they can get to work on cosmology and particle physics is to enter into the community of string theory, and that we're basically depriving the community of physicists of these people working on other approaches.
It's kind of hard to comment on that. I think that there are no data supporting string theory at this point. It's
absolutely
certainly fascinating, but that doesn't mean you can't pursue it, because maybe you'll find something that it will predict in terms of data acquisition, and you can run the classic scientific method on it.
And the important thing is to keep collecting the data.
Of course. And you're right, and you can't separate particle physics from astronomy anymore. I think that's one of the beautiful things about these sciences, is that we tend to separate them from one another into boxes, departments of physics, departments of astronomy, and so on. And they're not separable. They're always integrated in terms of astronomy, chemistry, physics. They're not separate sciences. They're different branches of the same.
Right.
Same science.
All right, let's go to line number three. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the mother of a very curious 3-year-old, and this will make you realize where your holes are in your knowledge when you have a 3-year-old constantly asking you why. I was wondering if you could recommend a book for children, small children, about the solar system, the moon cycles, everything having to do with
there are a lot of them out there. I don't keep track of them, and I don't have a list of children's books. The subject comes up every once in a while. I keep promising myself that I'm going to get a list together, and I never do it. But you can go to almost any high-end bookstore, Pages for All Ages, Borders or whatever, and Barnes & Noble, and you can go into the astronomy section, and you can usually find some pretty good stuff. The number of publishers have produced really fine books for young children. So that's really the only recommendation I have, but I don't really have any titles I can give you. I'm sorry.
Okay. So it would be in the actual astronomy section?
The larger bookstores have actual astronomy sections in them, in the science section, but they break. You see a little title of astronomy on there, and go just poke through it and see what looks at an appropriate reading level for a young kid.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I don't have a list of them. I never maintained one. It would keep changing all the time anyway.
That's true. All right, thank you.
Uh-huh. All right, good luck with that. Let's go to line number two. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? A really good subject. In the July 24th New Yorker, there's an article about, or a paper about the 10th planet, Michael Brown's discovery, Caltech's discovery of the supposed 10th planet. And he talked about, the article talks about an International Astronomical Union meeting in Prague and whether they were going to give a definitive definition of what a planet is. Has that a thing occurred yet? Or
I can't remember. The meeting is either now or mm-hmm. it was, but it's roughly contemporaneous to us right now. I don't know what they decided. Anybody who comes up with a definition of a planet is got to be a saint. It's almost impossible. People keep doing it. It becomes kind of a traditional thing. What you call the planet is a planet, and what you don't call a planet ain't a planet. You know, and that's kind of what it comes down to. The new critter. Xena, they were calling it informally, is about 5% or so bigger than Pluto. It's also very, very far away. And Pluto was considered a planet. It's part of what's called the Kuiper Belt, which is a debris belt out beyond the orbit of the last large planet, Neptune. And it just by a dedicated search by Clyde Tombaugh was discovered in 1930, and it took a long time to pick up some of the others. It required much greater technology to be able to get them. Now we're starting. We got about 1,000 of these things out there, and several of them approach Pluto, and one or two of them probably exceed Pluto in size. So you can get into a name game, but that's all it is. Personally, I'm in favor of saying, Pluto. Why can't Pluto be a planet and a member of the Kuiper Belt at the same time and be a transition object, which it sort of is, and everybody goes away happy. It's sort of the diplomatic approach.
Oh, yeah. because it said it was an arbitrary thing. And, you know, when you're a kid, you think, oh, nine planets. But then you realize after you read something like this or you even look at this stuff, you realize how really complex and how cultural it is.
Right, exactly.
But I was going to ask you something else. The earlier gentleman who called in and said something about the, the fake moon and rising, and also how Mars was close to. Do you see that as an attestation of just people's gullibility, or is it just the fact they don't think about what they're seeing,
or their
willingness to accept sort of like these hoaxes, which is really what they are?
Yeah.
I mean, could you address the idea of scientific education? I mean, I know that made it. I know it's not your field, but I know you deal with students all the time.
How much time you got?
A year, I guess. But I mean, I just wanted to ask you that because I noticed that these. It almost as if you can make a hoax, and it's more believable than actual scientific reasoning, and that really kind of bothers me. That's all.
If a picture like that is kind of the gee whiz factor, boy, isn't that nice and isn't that beautiful? Because it was a beautiful photograph, even if it was. I've still got it just as an example of hoaxdom, so to speak. It sits on my desk, and if I can find it on my desk, and this sort of thing has gone on. Science versus pseudoscience versus hoaxes for as long as I can remember and for all the century and to the past century and so on. People like to fool other people. And if you don't know enough about the subject, you can honestly be fooled. And that's true for all of us in any science. I could easily be fooled by something in biology, for example, and say, oh, yeah, gee whiz, isn't that amazing? Because I don't really know the field. And the big problem has always been, I think, in getting the word out in science and to the public in understandable forms and doing it in a form that is interesting to people so that they'll pay attention. That's the tough part of doing this. It's the sort of thing that I've always enjoyed doing, which is why we're sitting here on this radio program at the moment, in fact. New information. It's not a static business. New information comes in, and some of the honest discoveries that are coming in seem so weird and so spectacular that it's easy to fool somebody into something that is also weird and spectacular and wrong. So you got to keep the skin. It's a continuous challenge and one that scientists have not always met very well. I think NASA's done a pretty good job by mandating that all people who get NASA grants have to have a public component to it. And I have the feeling that that's going to go away, and I think that would be very sad.
Well, one thing I think people don't understand about science is that, indeed, what we know today is what we know today, but...
Some of what we know today is wrong.
That's right. But then people see that as somehow that means science is flawed, and that they don't understand the fact that it's always
the beauty of science, and it's almost sad to have it compartmentalized into a word, science. It's just a matter of you're looking at nature and how it works, and everybody loves to do this. You go out in the garden, you watch the bugs fly around and crawl through your garden, watch the flowers, look up at the sky. It's all part of nature. It's all part of the same thing. And it's just a matter of trying to understand the underpinnings of it and how it all comes about. It's like the score of a symphony, and you want to understand the score.
Yeah.
And it keeps, unfortunately, I guess fortunately, because that's what makes science fun, the score keeps changing. It's flexible. And sometimes what you know is wrong, and sometimes but there's so much out there that we don't know, and of course we don't know what that is because we don't know. You know, but that's what makes it a great adventure.
Let's try and get one more call in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I've actually got a question more about the future, I suppose, of stargazing and astronomy. Recently, I was able to go and see the Al Gore Inconvenient Truth movie. And after watching that, you know, I've been thinking we actually had an opportunity to view Saturn unobstructed from the U of I Observatory quite a while back, and it was really pretty cool.
Isn't that? Yeah, we've had students who think, oh, you had a slide up there, you painted it on.
It isn't as crisp and clear as I thought it would be, but it's certainly very solid and visible and beautiful. And I guess I wondered, as CO2 emissions, you know, rise, you know, not necessarily just in the United States, but all over the world, will eventually ground viewing be more difficult?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. It'll certainly affect the infrared, where the heat radiation can't escape from the Earth. And I pointed out before, it can't get in either. And it will probably affect turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere, but which affects seeing and twinkling and so on, but in ways that I'm afraid I don't think anybody can predict. But everything seems to affect everything else, and it probably will have an effect. Right now, we're more concerned as just from the purely observational standpoint. I mean, people are much more concerned with light pollution, which is driving telescopes, which is making observations from any place other than you know, distant mountain peaks, where you want to be anyway, much more difficult. But of course, the global warming is going to affect humidity. It's going to affect all kinds of things, and in unpredictable ways.
We are going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. I want to thank all callers. If you're interested in knowing something about astronomy or perhaps just learning something about what you can see the sky various times of the year, you can go to the U of I Astronomy Department webpage, www.astro.uiuc.edu, and you can see Jim's column, Skylights, which changes every week. Has a star of the week, has a photograph that changes all the time. So that's one place you can go to get a little information, a little tip-off of about where to look and what to look for in the sky. And thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Jim Kaler, he's an astronomy professor emeritus of astronomy here at the University of Illinois, and occasionally he's with us to talk about what's in the sky.